It's been a quarter century since a Columbus native took the sports world by surprise. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score, 89.7's weekly look at sports. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week we'll talk about the chances of the new Major League Baseball commissioner finally letting Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame.
We'll also talk about Ohio State men's hockey and what's wrong with the team this year compared to their success last year.
But first, it's been 25 years since a Columbus boxer shocked the world.
He may not be able to recover. It's up to 7 and 8. He's not going to make it.
James Buster Douglas went to Tokyo in 1990 as a 42-1 underdog and knocked out Mike Tyson to win the heavyweight championship and to give Tyson his first career loss. Joining me to talk about that is Tim May, who covered the fight for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for your time, Tim.
Sure, man, anytime.
Saying Buster Douglas was an underdog is really a massive understatement. Tyson was considered a shoe-in to defend the title, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically that fight was seen as a stepping stone fight for Mike Tyson's much-anticipated showdown with Evander Holyfield, which, ironically, a day or so before the fight, I mean, several parties, including Donald Trump, flew in to promote the next Tyson fight, which was Tyson-Holyfield, I think was going to be in June Atlantic City. And I asked a couple of them after the press conference they had that day, well, what happens if Buster beats Tyson? Does he get that fight? And they started laughing, go, oh, that'll never happen.
So Douglas grew up in Linden here in Columbus. He went to Linden McKinley High School. How did he get all the way to Tokyo to fight Mike Tyson? Tell us about his early life.
Sort of took a really slow rocket ride. I mean, he was, you know, I think he saw himself at one point as a potential NBA player. He was on a state championship team at Linden McKinley, and then that didn't quite work out, but got into boxing because his dad, of course, was a very well-known middleweight, light heavyweight, Bill Dynamite Douglas. And, you know, if you ever watch Buster, in my opinion, is one of the great combinations of his mom and his dad, because he's got an incredible gentle side to him, a real humanitarian side to him. But also, if you get him riled up and you get him in great shape, he can knock you out with one punch. And bottom line is, he didn't always harness the boxing side of him of himself at certain times during his boxing career. But you could see the potential there because he was much bigger than his dad and 6'4", could throw the jab like you wouldn't believe. And if you ever put it all together, you know he was going to be a force to behold. And but kind of not being able to put it all together on a consistent basis kind of held him back a little bit. But finally, you know, he ends up with that fight with Mike Tyson because his manager, number one, John Johnson, do not leave him out of the story. He's the one who kept badgering Don King about giving Buster Douglas another shot after Buster Douglas lost to Tony Tucker for the IBF championship a year or so earlier, a couple of years earlier. And lo and behold, the Razor Ruddock Mike Tyson fight falls apart, proposed fight falls apart, and they need a last-minute fill-in, and they find a promoter, people willing to put up the money in Tokyo, and they ask Buster Douglas if he wants to fight in it, and they take the fight with, like, basically 2 months' notice, and the next thing you know, it's boxing history.
So Douglas fell out of the national spotlight almost as quick as he came into it. He beat Tyson, then he lost his first title defense against Evander Holyfield. He retired after that fight and then nearly reached 400 pounds before making a comeback, and he netted a few fights, but nothing ever approaching that Tyson pinnacle.
No, I mean, he almost died, actually, from a diabetic situation at one point during all that. And but, you know, I've said this to him. I've said this to groups. You know, it would have been really nice to see him reign for a while, but I'm not sure reigning was ever in Buster's makeup. Bottom line is, you cannot take away, no matter what happened afterwards or even before, you can't take away from the fact that he did pull the greatest upset in boxing history. You know what I mean? I'm not sure what you do after that. Except kind of sit around and enjoy the fruits of your labor.
Well, what's he doing now?
He's he's involved in several charity things. Matter of fact, the 25th anniversary celebration, which is on Wednesday night at the Villa Milano in Columbus, is all about raising money for the Stephanie Spielman Fund and also for the Maria Tiberi Foundation. Basically, as he and John Johnson say, they're trying to help save lives the best they can. But he just kind of has his hand in a lot of things. But one of those is he's into coaching a little Golden Gloves team, or helping coach a Golden Gloves team, which he had down in Kentucky a week ago, and he really enjoys interacting with young up and coming boxers who are really just young kids trying to find their way in life.
Tim May is a sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He was in Tokyo when Columbus native Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson to win the heavyweight title. Thanks again, Tim.
Sure, man. Anytime.
We spent plenty of time talking about the Blue Jackets hockey team on this show. We're going to take a break this week and focus on the Ohio State men's hockey team.
To talk about how the hockey team is doing this season and how they're progressing in Big Ten play, we have with us from the digital media department, Grant Miller. He's a writer and editor for the Ohio State Lantern and an intern here at WOC Public Media. Grant, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Thomas. I appreciate it.
Let's talk about the hockey team this year. How are they doing? How are they playing? And what does the outlook for the rest of the season look like?
Well, none of those things you could really answer positively. They're 7-15-2 right now, going towards the end of their season, about a month or so, and they just haven't been playing very well in general. The season did start promisingly. They beat a Providence team here in Columbus that was ranked in the top five in overtime, and then the second game they lost in overtime. But since then, it's just been a very, very poor year, only four or five wins since then. They're actually going into this weekend off the back of six straight losses. So it's just one of those things where last year, where they did have a very, very successful season under first-year head coach Steve Rolick, whereas this year there's been some transition issues, and it's really been a surprise to a lot of people in the hockey community.
I mentioned before this is the second year for Big Ten hockey. Before, they were in the CCHA conference with a bunch of similar schools and a lot more schools. But this year, they're in the second year of the Big Ten. There's just six schools. Talk about how this transition to Big Ten hockey has been playing out so far.
Well, it's been a big success in a lot of ways. The Big Ten's been a lot more visible hockey-wise. A lot of these schools are getting a lot more visibility with their hockey programs. Michigan State, Ohio State, teams that have always kind of been around the periphery in the highest rankings of hockey. And then you have the big schools like Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which have been doing so well for so many years. And then Penn State, which just became a varsity sport over there in Pennsylvania the other year. And they've really been doing extremely well this year. They're in second place, actually, this season, after being in last season. But really, when it comes to visibility and TV, I mean, a lot of the Ohio State games were on TV last year, whereas in the past, you know, probably you would just get some here and there that you'd be able to view across the nation. A lot of these games have been on the Big Ten Network. Some Ohio State games have even been on ESPN in the past 2 years. So from the Big Ten's perspective, it's been a very big success because you have all these very good programs together in this one conference, and it's definitely shown very brightly.
Last year, Ohio State was just 6 minutes away from winning the Big Ten tournament and heading off to the NCAA tournament, but they ultimately fell to Wisconsin, and that's who Ohio State has this weekend. So they're going to be a little revenge that the Buckeyes are going to be looking for against Wisconsin as Wisconsin travels to the Shot for a Friday and Saturday game.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, like you said, 6 minutes away from the first NCAA tournament appearance in a number of years, and that team had really worked so hard. They started 0-3 last season. They wound up using six different goalies on the roster, but once it came time for the stretch run of the Big Ten, they were absolutely outstanding, and they really had a tremendous end of the season. They beat Minnesota, who was the number one team in the country, not only at their end of the regular season, but they beat them in the semifinals of the Big Ten tournament. And as you said, they were actually up 4-2 late in the third period against Wisconsin before two late Badger goals tied the game, and then they eventually won it in overtime. And actually, head coach Steve Rolick, that we mentioned earlier, is an alum of Wisconsin. He actually won a national championship there as a player back in 1990. So it's going to be a game that they're going to have a lot on their minds. And really, if they want to get the season back on track in any capacity, they're going to need to get some good results this weekend.
Some of the factors playing into a down season for Ohio State hockey is the fact that their two top scorers are no longer playing for the Buckeyes, even though they didn't graduate. Talk about where they're at and why they're not playing right now.
Well, those top two scorers you mentioned are Ryan DeZingle and Max McCormick. They were both juniors last year and led the team. DeZingle had a great year, 22 goals, 24 assists. He was their star, really had a lot of great games, especially in front of national audiences. And then Max McCormick, his line mate, had 11 goals and 24 assists. But they were both juniors, and they both decided to go pro because they were both actually been drafted by the Ottawa Senators. So they're both playing with the Ottawa Senators farm team, the Binghamton Senators, and doing pretty well. A lot of them getting, both of them getting a lot of playing time. And it's really been that lack of scoring production that's really haunted Ohio State a lot of times this season. Both of those guys last season, a lot of instances, would drag Ohio State out of a hole, DeZingle especially, when they needed a big goal. Down the stretch, I remember he had a goal against Michigan State in the Big Ten tournament right when they needed it, right when they needed to get back in the game. And those type of performances and really, really important ones just haven't been there for the Buckeyes this season.
With the six teams in the Big Ten, does every team make the Big Ten tournament, ultimately still giving the Buckeyes a chance to make the NCAA tournament?
Definitely, and that's one of the things with the tournament. It is that card that you're always going to have up your sleeve to potentially make the NCAAs, but it's just a really tough conference. And I mean, playing in it all season, as Rolick kind of alluded to a lot last year, is always going to be a grind. Every single weekend is going to be a very tough set of games. And then once you get in that tournament, you really got to find yourself on a roll towards the end of the regular season if you're going to do anything in it. And Ohio State had that last year. So I guess from that standpoint, if they can get some positive results in the next few weeks, and especially the last few games of the regular season, and find themselves in a good spot and maybe a few good matchups with teams like a Minnesota or Wisconsin, who are probably already guaranteed a spot in the NCAA tournament, no matter how they do in the Big Ten tournament, then you know maybe we could see them making a run.
Ohio State hosts Wisconsin this weekend. They have a game on Friday night and a game on Saturday. Grant Miller is from the Lantern newspaper and an intern here at WOSU Public Media. Grant, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for having me on, Thomas.
The NFL is king of the sports world with the most viewers and obviously revenue.
A lot of people don't know this, but the NFL founded right here in Columbus.
It was. It got its starts thanks to a guy named Joe F. Carr.
The league's first headquarters, even in downtown Columbus, right across the street from the statehouse.
The NFL's early days are the subject of the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr. It was written by Chris Willis, and Steve and I spoke to Chris back when this show was just a podcast. So we wanted to pull that interview from the archives for you.
Chris Willis, welcome to After the Score.
Thanks for having me.
So Joseph Carr was obviously an interesting guy with this great story. Let's start from the beginning. He grew up in Columbus. Tell us about his life and then how he got involved in the business of football.
Yeah, Joe Carr was was born and raised there in Columbus, Ohio, sort of in where the Irish neighborhood was, kind of where Columbus State is technically now, you know, is where the Irish neighborhood, you know, was.
Near downtown.
Yes. Yeah. So he was born in 1879. His dad was a shoemaker and then owned a grocery store slash saloon, you know, during that time, and was really involved in sports growing up, you know, sort of after what would you call middle school is when he sort of took off. He became a sports writer first at the Ohio State Journal and then part time he was working at the Columbus Panhandle Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad, and that's where he sort of saw some of the football players like the Nesser brothers and the Columbus Panhandles, you know, starting out, you know, with the football. So the sports writing grew into running the football team. He helped run the Columbus Senators baseball team. So sports was always sort of something he loved and gravitated to, although he did not play them. He was a smaller man, you know, under 6 foot, but he loved just, you know, the organization and sort of the potential of organizing sports and following sports in different realms more than an athlete. And that started right there in Columbus, right there in Central Ohio, and became a very popular man in the sports scene, like I said, starting with his sports writing days and then sort of running baseball and football teams there in Central Ohio.
Chris, I have to be honest. I've lived in Columbus a lot of my life and never heard of the Columbus Panhandles. This is a professional football team from the early 1900s.
I get that a lot, too. I was born in Columbus. I grew up in German Village, and I think for most of us, we gravitated to high state football, and we love college football, and then you had the pro teams there in the state, and you kind of forget that the NFL and the Columbus Panhandles, which was an early successful pro team, was established right there in Central Ohio, and that way we had a very successful professional team that got started in the NFL, and they sort of got older once the NFL sort of took off in the 20s and 30s, and also the popularity of Ohio State took over too. It was going to be a college town, and to give credit to Joe Carr, he saw that. I mean, he was involved in the early days of the NFL. He saw, hey, this is probably going to be a college town. The university is very popular. Ohio Stadium was just being built. They were taking off. He's like, we need to be in a little bit bigger cities. And mm-hmm. So for most Central Highlands, Joe Carr and the Columbus Panhandles doesn't ring a bell as much as maybe Ohio State football.
We're talking about Columbus's ties to the National Football League and its founder, Columbus native Joe Carr. We're joined by Chris Willis, the author of the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr. So, Chris, tell us about the NFL's early days. You told us how Mr. Carr founded the league. How did the league start in its infant stages, and then how did it develop into this monstrosity it is now?
Well, especially in the 20s and 30s, and I think that's where Joe Carr kind of gets lost in the history of the National Football League, is he and some of these other owners sort of built what the foundation is now, and he was really one of the big force in that, and one of his main accomplishments was moving the NFL from the small towns of those early years to the big cities, and finding financially capable owners to run them. So when you see the Mara family running the Giants now, the Rooney family running, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Detroit Lions came into the league, the Cleveland Rams, which became now the St. Louis Rams, mm-hmm. The Washington Redskins, he helped recruit some of these owners to help solidify the league that sort of, that's what we sit on now.
It was more of a minor league kind of barnstorming type thing back then.
Yeah, there was a lot of travel teams. There was a lot of teams that just would come in for a few years, run out of money, and then and leave. And Joe, saw that, and some of the early owners like George Halas, and like I said, Art Rooney, they saw, look, in order for us to be more established and have that continuity year in and year out, we need to be in the big cities first, kind of like Major League Baseball at the time, that only had about 12 teams, and we need financial capable owners that sort of, hey, they might take some hits early. I mean, the Rooney family and the Mara family, they lost a lot of money in those early years, and then they saw that, hey, this could be a really good sport. It could be popular. Let's make it entertaining. And they saw that as those early owners, and that helped sort of where we sit now. When you look at back at it and you look at some of these owners that are well established and the cities that they're in, it's not minor league. It's not year to year. Oh, we're going to have these franchises. We're going to have these players. It's pretty well established. And that was, like I said, at the end of the 30s, that was being established, and they were 10 teams. They're very successful. They were going to be successful. They had owners that wanted to be successful, and that's where Carr sort of influences those, what we sit on today is, hey, this is where the NFL could be.
Yeah, just a few things that Joe Carr did. He created the organization's first constitution, implemented standard player contracts, and helped develop the NFL draft. So he was really ahead of his time, even at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were things that, now we take for granted. You look at, oh, wow, that's been in place for 50 years. But back then, they were new, to do, contracts so players don't jump from team to team, to have constitution and bylaws, to follow. And the draft was another huge thing. That was a big gamble for those owners, the Bears – the Bears and the Giants in the big cities, they were dominating the NFL at that time, winning championships. And those teams like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh were just getting – they were struggling. But the Bears and the Giants had all the money to get the best players, and they were. So, but Halas and Mara and some of those owners sacrificed, say, look, and Carr led it, say, look, this is better for the league. When the players come in now, the teams that had the worst records now get the best opportunity to get those players, So that, and like I said, now we take that for granted. Oh, that's easy. It's competitive balances, what they call it. But a lot of those early things were just getting started. They were just brand new. Hey, let's do a draft. Like I said, let's, Let's do statistics. Let's split the National Football League into two, divisions and have a world championship game. All that stuff was being discussed, in the 20s and throughout the 30s. And now we take that for granted.
We're talking about Columbus's ties to the National Football League and its founder, Columbus native Joseph Carr. We're speaking with Chris Willis, who wrote the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr.
Yeah, Columbus was headquartered, or the NFL was headquartered in Columbus while Joe Carr was president. Did the NFL kind of reach its ceiling in Columbus and have to move on? Or are there any current connections to the NFL in Columbus right now?
Well, to your first part of your question, yes. When Joe Carr became the NFL president in 1921, which was the second year of the National Football League, Jim Thorpe was the first year, and he was an athlete. He was not an administrator. So Joe Carr took over, and the first thing he did was set up a headquarters. We need a headquarters, and he put it right there in Columbus, Ohio. It's a Broad and High, 16 East Broad. The Hayden Building is still there. So if you're down there at the intersection, that's where the first NFL office was. And then, unfortunately, when he passed away in 1939, he was still in office. He passed away from a second heart attack. He still would have kept the office there. It bounced around a little once they started getting new commissioners. They went to Chicago first and then Philadelphia with Burt Bell, and then obviously to New York when Pete Rozelle became commissioner. But that's a really nice historical piece of history there in Columbus that, hey, we have the first headquarters, and it's still there. The building is still there, the 11th floor there, at that building at 16 East Broad. But right now, because of the popularity of Ohio State, like I said, it gets totally lost. I think a lot of people, like I said, we've talked about Columbus not knowing that history. Hey, we were part of the early history of the NFL, with the headquarters and an early pro team. And but now there's no historical marker down there. There's no sort of recognition down there, which is a little unfortunate. I think slowly but surely some people are starting to recognize that. Hopefully, some people there, within the offices down there, can kind of, hey, this is part of our history. But it does get lost. I don't think it comes to mind very quickly for people there in Central Ohio that, hey, this is where a really good early NFL history is still there.
Yeah, like I said, I've lived in Columbus a long time and never even knew about this. Well, this has been a really great informative discussion. Chris Willis wrote the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr, who was from Columbus and wrote about Columbus being the first home, the first headquarters of the National Football League. Chris, thanks again.
Thanks, Steve and Thomas, for having me. Appreciate it.
So as we said at the top of the show, Pete Rose has another chance potentially to go into the Hall of Fame with the new Major League Baseball commissioner, Rob Manfred.
The all-time leader in hits was, of course, banned from the Baseball Hall of Fame and baseball altogether for betting on baseball. And it looks like in an interview, Manfred said he's open to the possibility of reconsidering Pete Rose's case.
Yeah, and it's been approaching 30 years. I don't have any doubt that Pete Rose is one of the better players to ever live. He's just a documented liar.
Yeah.
And he looked into the camera for 25 years or so and said, I'm not lying. I'm not lying. I'm not lying. Very genuinely. But he was lying the whole time. So I don't feel any sympathy for Pete Rose. I guess I am of the mindset that let people in and let the Hall of Fame be a museum for good and bad.
I don't think that, the Hall of Fame is not a museum for whether you're a good person or an honest person. He has the most hits in Major League Baseball history. That's him alone. The fact that he's not in the Hall of Fame because he lied about betting on baseball and he's banned from baseball, I don't think those two things should go together. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame for his attributes on the field in the diamond and not what he did off the field and in a sports book somewhere.
Should they mention that in the Hall of Fame, though? Should they mention that he was banned for nearly 30 years then finally let in?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's part of his story. It's part of the Pete Rose story. Mm-hmm. But I think to have a shrine to baseball and not have one of your most decorated athletes in that shrine is a mistake.
For a long time, I was against Pete Rose going into the Hall of Fame. Maybe it was just a personal issue with him, again, with him looking into a camera and lying for more than 20 years. I guess, I don't know, maybe if I'm part of the public shift towards being more open to him going into the Hall of Fame, I wonder if I'm representative of society at large.
I think we've seen a lot of players in baseball lying over the years, and most of them have been lying about things that affected their on-the-field performance. Pete Rose didn't do any of that. He lied about his personal life. He lied about a gambling problem and betting on baseball. You look at a Barry Bonds, who, by what he's done on the field, should be in the Hall of Fame, but he probably never will because he took steroids to get to that point. But Pete Rose lied, and that's a personal problem. Barry Bonds lied to create a professional gain on the field.
Something else local sports fans are talking about right now, Mark Loving from the Ohio State basketball team. He returns to the lineup Saturday after being previously suspended by head coach Thad Matta. Do we know yet why he was suspended?
I don't think we'll ever know. It could be a combination of violation of team rules. It could be grades. It could be legal trouble. Right now, nobody knows. And honestly, I think Ohio State basketball has done a good job of keeping that under wraps. He missed, I think, three games, and he's going to return Saturday against Michigan State. Of course, Loving is the sophomore from Toledo, Ohio, the three-point specialist. Mm-hmm. It'll be nice to have him back in the lineup to help, you know, Sam Thompson and D'Angelo Russell really improve this team.
Yeah, and they have been improving already. Ohio State won five of its last six. They look to be peaking at the right time going into mid to late February, and the addition of Loving really should help them with a strong close to the Big Ten season.
And we would have talked about the Cleveland Cavaliers, but this week is the NBA All-Star break.
That's right. It's a fun time of year, especially for big NBA fans. There's the three-point contest, the dunk contest, and, of course, the NBA All-Star game. The Cavs have two players, LeBron James and Kyrie Irving. The highly touted Kevin Love for the Cavs did not make this year's team.
He didn't, and it was supposed to be the big three for the Cavs, and Kevin Love hasn't been the piece they thought he'd be, but it's nice to see two Cavaliers in the All-Star game with a whole bunch of Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah, that's not something we've really said in the past. A lot of Hawks making the All-Star game. Also from the West, a lot of Blazers on the team. Clippers also represented. And Anthony Davis, who at this point might be knocking on the door to be the best player in the NBA.
I think he's the best player. I think by far he's the MVP. He's got a set of skills that nobody else in the league can mimic, and he's playing his position better than anyone else is playing their position right now. One thing I'm looking forward to, especially in an all-star type setting, I want to see how many three-pointers Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson make. These two guys shoot the ball like none other in regular season games, and in a game where there's no defense, these guys, I wouldn't be surprised if they combine for 20 to 25 three-pointers.
We mentioned the NBA All-Star Game. Time now for a look at the rest of the weekend in sports.
Number 23 Ohio State basketball travels to Michigan State, and that game is on at noon on Saturday and can be seen on ESPN.
Like we said, Mark Loving making his return to the game, to the team in that game. Then later Saturday night, Syracuse hosts number 4 Duke. That's also on ESPN.
Yeah, top-ranked Kentucky should have no problem when South Carolina comes to town. And second-ranked Virginia will host unranked Wake Forest.
The Cavs are off, of course, because of the All-Star game. Moving now to hockey, the Jackets host the Flyers tonight. That game starts in just about 5 minutes, so I imagine a lot of people going into the arena right now or trying to find parking. Don't worry, you've got a few minutes yet.
Yeah, they still have to sing the national anthem, but move it to a brisk walk, I guess. Quick turnaround for the Jackets. They're going to hop on a plane right after the game and head to New York to take on the Islanders tomorrow night.
And that will do it for this week's episode of After the Score. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. Until then, you can find an archive of episodes using the WOSU Public Media mobile app.
You can always follow us on Twitter at After the Score. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.